On today's programme, hanging in the balance, what next for the Northern Ireland Assembly, the Irish Language Act and the protocol after the departure of Edwin Poots. Down in the polls on the week of its party's Ardesh, we run the rule over Fine Gael's performance in government. Also, the Sisters of Charity say they were not approached by the government about the purchase of land for the new National Maternity Hospital. We'll ask what's going on. And foreign travel. When will we be ready to roll out the new digital COVID certificate? All of that coming up after the news, read now by Brian Finn. Brian, thank you very much. Good afternoon and welcome to the programme. Justin McCarthy here, standing in for Katie Hannan for the next few weeks. My panel today, Simon Coveney, Minister for Foreign Affairs and Defence and Fine Gael Deputy Leader, Matt Carty, Sinn Féin Spokesman on Agriculture, Jennifer Whitmore, Social Democrat Spokesperson on Climate, Environment and Biodiversity. You can text the programme on 51551, email saturday at rte.ie or tweet the programme on at SaturdayRTE. Now let's go first to Minister Simon Coveney in our Cork studio. Minister, good afternoon. We'll talk to you about your party's Ardesh in just a moment, but I want to ask you about the events of the last few days in Northern Ireland, dramatic events. And there was a statement which came in overnight from the Loyalist Communities Council, which is made up of Loyalist paramilitary groups, and it's warning the next DUP leader to stop concessions to Sinn Féin, and also warning Irish government ministers, no doubt including yourself, and officials, that they're no longer welcome in Northern Ireland. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's very unhelpful as an intervention. It just drives more tension and more polarisation in terms of language, and that's not the way we're going to solve anything. You know, the way in which you solve problems in Northern Ireland where there are deep divisions in terms of people's perspectives is through dialogue, through discussion. And so the idea that some in the Loyalist community would be blaming the Dublin government, as they call it, for all the woes linked to Brexit and the protocol simply isn't accurate. That's the first thing. But, you know, we are the ones that are now looking for the compromises and the pragmatism that can actually help to ensure that the protocol can be implemented in a way that is more acceptable. And so the idea that we are effectively demonised by leaders within loyalism is really unhelpful. And whatever about saying that politicians are not welcome, to say that they're officials as well. I mean, we have people
who
are living and working.
Is there an implied threat there, Minister? I mean, do you see that as being a little bit more sinister than just being unwelcome?
Well, I mean, some people have interpreted it in that way. I think it would be helpful if political leaders in Northern Ireland who represent unionists and loyalist communities would come out and actually clarify that there is no threat to officials or politicians from the Irish government, because we have a permanent presence in Northern Ireland in terms of our officials. They're doing a fantastic job constantly trying to reach out and listen to people and feeding back to me and the Taoiseach's offices. And the idea that there would be a signal that an Irish government presence is no longer welcome in Northern Ireland, I think is a huge backward step.
Okay.
Particularly given the challenges we've got to face together. The challenges don't go away because the blame game becomes more aggressive. If anything, they get worse. So the protocol issues, which they're primarily referring to, are issues that have been negotiated and agreed by the British government and the EU. The Irish government, of course, is part of those negotiations, but only part of those negotiations. And what we are all trying to do now is to calm tensions, listen to people's concerns, see how we can respond to those concerns within the parameters of the protocol, which is international law, and show the kind of generosity and flexibility that's necessary in those responses, which I think the EU is up for doing, if the British government is as well. And so this idea that somehow we shut out Dublin or the Republic of Ireland out of Northern Ireland, which is what some people seem to be calling for now, that we demonise, legitimate calls, for example, for the implementation of what was agreed in terms of language and culture legislation, which involves the Irish language,
okay,
but also Ulster Scots.
I want to ask you, Minister, what was the Irish government's involvement, or did you have an involvement, you or your officials, in the deal that was done involving Edwin Poots, involving Sinn Féin, to get Westminster to deal with the Irish Language Act. Was the Irish government a part of that of the negotiations around that deal as well?
Of course we were. I mean, you know, we're involved in all negotiations that involve the implementation of the New Decade, New Approach Agreement, which was signed up to after more than 2 years of negotiation, which, you know, and I spent virtually every week a number of days in Belfast as part of that negotiation. So, of course, we're involved
in its implementation. But New Decade, New Approach, Minister, was designed to get the Assembly to do the work, not to get Westminster to do it. And the fact that Westminster was asked to deal with Irish language, doesn't that completely undermine the Stormont Assembly then?
No, look, let's not focus solely on negatives here. Okay, what happened in the last number of days was that the Secretary of State, Brandon Lewis, agreed. And we had spoken about this some time ago. You know, we met and had a long conversation on this in Lockern 10 days ago. And what was agreed was that we would try to work with all of the parties to ensure that all elements of the New Decade, New Approach Agreement were implemented. We knew that the Irish language legislation was something that was outstanding. As well as legislation that also, that same legislation deals with Ulster Scots and sets up commissioners to promote both languages. It was clearly part of the challenge of getting a new First Minister both nominated and accepted, that actually this element of the New Decade, New Approach Agreement would be clarified in terms of implementation, because this was one of the most difficult things to get agreement on. And so what the British government has said, and I think they're right to do it, is they've said, look, let's give some time and space to a new executive with a new First Minister and with the same Deputy First Minister, give them time and space to actually legislate as they agreed they would for language and culture around Irish language and Ulster Scots. If they can't do it by October, well, then the British government will do it in Westminster, just like they've had to do in other areas, whether that's equal marriage, whether it's abortion services and so on.
And as we know, though, that triggered a major crisis in the DUP. And I want to ask you, do you expect the Northern Ireland First Minister, Paul Given, to remain in his position now, given the events that have taken place this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to be accurate here. I mean, I think while that decision did trigger real difficulty within the DUP, I mean, there has been real tension within the DUP for some time now. I mean, don't forget, the DUP has only ever had four leaders. They don't do leadership change very often. And so, you know, when Edwin Poots won the leadership, it was a very, very close contest with Geoffrey Donaldson. There was only a couple of votes in it. So the party clearly was divided. And this certainly was a trigger that ultimately resulted in the end of Edwin Poots' leadership.
I just want to ask you about Paul Given, the First Minister that's in place at the moment, because there are reports that he has been asked by party officers to resign. Now, the DUP is not commenting on those reports today. But what's your expectation in relation to his position?
Well, I mean, this is a matter for the DUP. I mean, they're the largest political party in Northern Ireland. They need to nominate their candidate for First Minister. They have, under Edwin Poots' leadership, they appointed Paul Given, and that was accepted under the deal that was agreed with the Secretary of State. And obviously, you know, we were involved in all of those conversations with the parties as well as with the Secretary of State. Now there's going to be a leadership change in the DUP, and it's really up to that new leader when they're appointed to ensure that they have the team that they want in Stormont.
Does it trigger another crisis, though, if Paul Given goes? Because you're into bargaining then, perhaps around the protocol, in order for a First Minister to be installed.
But you can't bargain around the protocol for a First Minister to be installed in Northern Ireland. I mean, that's a negotiation with the EU. I mean, and the EU isn't going to get boxed into a situation where they have to give concessions in a way that's inconsistent with international law to facilitate the nomination of a First Minister in Northern Ireland. I mean, I think we need to be realistic here and what's possible. I think the DUP will be realistic, by the way. You know, this is an experienced party that they've had a terrible number of weeks. I think they will now look to putting a new leader in place quickly and to provide stability behind that person. And we need to give them the space and time to do that. I also think other parties in the executive will be responsible in terms of trying to get that new First Minister in place, if there is a new First Minister, or if Paul Given remains in office.
But the
core issue here is about the people of Northern Ireland. And the jockeying for position within political parties and the very polarised and quite aggressive political debate that we've seen in recent weeks has got to calm down. The Irish government and the British government have got to be a stabilising influence where we can be, and we've got to work with parties, all of the parties, to make sure that we focus on what's good for Northern Ireland.
All right. I want to ask you about your party's Ardesh, which is underway online this week. There's some material being trailed in the newspapers today about what the Taoiseach, your party leader, Leo Varadkar, is likely to say in his leader's address this evening. And the reports suggest that he will propose that the health service should keep the additional €4 billion allocated during the pandemic for emergency spending and other spending in last year's budget. That would be an unprecedented increase in health spending. Isn't he effectively, though, saying that we'll have to keep borrowing for another few years? Because when you add that health spending to the commitments on tax changes, to the MICA scheme, to the corporation tax losses, and to the redress scheme, I mean, you'd wonder where all that money is going to come from.
Well, it has to come from economic growth. I mean, that's where it has to come from. I mean, unlike other parties, Fine Gael doesn't propose more and more and more spending without actually a credible plan as to how we create the wealth to do that. And it's because of that thinking that the Irish government has been able to borrow very large sums of money at very low cost to be able to respond to COVID because of Fine Gael's management of the economy for a decade or so. And we will continue to provide that kind of economic management, I hope, into the future, where we want to be able to spend more money, to be able to provide essential public services, particularly in healthcare post-COVID, because we are going to have enormous pressures in a post-COVID world where everything from mental health to family breakdown to a whole series of issues that have had to be put on hold in terms of their development and investment because of the response to a pandemic. So what Leo Varadkar is saying is he wants to prioritise healthcare and prioritise health spend in the years ahead in response to the lessons we've learned through the pandemic, where we have actually found ways, despite all of the pressure, of designing more efficiency into the system, managing waiting lists better,
Are you and your party saying today, then, Minister, that €4 billion, which was supposed to be, I think €2 billion of it was emergency pandemic spending, that won't be taken back off the health service in the budget?
What we're saying is that we have increased the size of our health service in response to a pandemic, and it's the judgment of Fine Gael that we should keep the health service at that size to be able to avoid the kind of pressures that I think we would have experienced over the last 10 years, where we were trying to rebuild a health service after a deep economic recession, where we couldn't afford to spend what we otherwise would have been spending on healthcare. We have been forced by a pandemic to spend a lot of extra money over a very short period of time, which is not sustainable, by the way, in terms of those increases year after year. But what we want to do now is find a way of maintaining the scale that has been created to deal with the pandemic and all the other issues that we face at the same time, to make sure that we provide a health service that people can have faith in and be proud of. And, in my view, health services through the pandemic period have been nothing short of heroic. The HSE has had to deal with so many challenges at the same time. And if you speak to someone like Paul Reid, he will say that they have learned very significant lessons from that journey and that pressure, and they now want to apply those lessons learned to a larger health service that can ensure that we don't face what we would have faced a number of years ago in terms of waiting lists, trolley numbers and pressure on our hospital system in particular.
Your partners in government, Fianna Fáil, seem to have got a bit of a vaccine boost or a vaccine bonus in the opinion polls, but Fine Gael didn't pick that one up at all. I wonder, do you have a view as to why that might be?
Look, I mean, I don't read too much into one opinion poll. You know, I mean, we've had multiple opinion polls since the last general election. Fine Gael has bounced back very strongly from a poor general election result. And, you know, you can read all sorts of things into the ups and downs of opinion polls, but we've been steadily in the high 20s or early 30s for the last 12 months. And look, you know, for us, the immediate challenges are good governance, managing hopefully the end of this pandemic in the months ahead, winning a by-election in Dublin Bay South with a fantastic candidate, James Gagan, and focusing on the challenges and the planning that we need to put in place to make sure that we protect the public, that we get an economy growing again, we get people back to work. And so there will be ups and downs along the road from an opinion poll perspective, but we're not going to get carried away on the good days, and we're certainly not going to get panicked on the bad days. I mean, if you look at that poll, satisfaction with the government is up significantly. Leo Varadkar is by far the most popular political leader. The strength of support amongst young people in Fine Gael is almost double what it was in the general election. So, you know, there are good numbers there for us, but there are also some challenges. Okay. And I mean, let's not get carried away with one opinion poll.
You mentioned your candidate's name there in the Dublin Bay South by-election. So I have to tell people who all of the other candidates running in the election are. So there's Ivana Bacik in Labour, Lynn Boylan from Sinn Féin, Deirdre Conroy of Fianna Fáil, Sarah Durkin from the Social Democrats, Mairead Tobin, Aim 2, Bridget Purcell, People Before Profit, Claire Byrne, Green Party, Manix Flynn, Independent, Justin Barrett from the National Party, Peter Dooley, Independent, and Jackie Gilborne from Renew. So
you sound like you were ready for that one, Justin.
I was indeed. Also, though, in that poll, Minister, it shows that voters' attentions are turning now back to core political issues, away perhaps from the pandemic somewhat towards core issues: health, economy, and housing. And I just wanted to ask you on housing, what's your response to the charge by Pierce Doherty this week that your party leader, Leo Varadkar, doesn't get the anger that's out there on housing? Because the Taoiseach pointed out during the week that house prices now are cheaper than they were during the Celtic Tiger era. And I'm just wondering, doesn't that come across as a bit tone deaf given the fact that people are having such difficulty accessing housing at the moment?
Look, I can assure you Fine Gael are not tone deaf on housing. I mean, I'm a former housing minister and I know how essential it is that housing policy works for people, for their families, for young people in particular who are trying to get on the housing ladder, for people who are paying far too much for rent at the moment. But ultimately, this is primarily about a supply issue: social housing supply, affordable housing supply, cost rental supply, and private housing supply. And what Damien English is saying today in the Fine Gael Ardèche is absolutely right. We need to get onto a place where we can deliver 30,000 housing units or more per year for two decades to deal fundamentally with a problem where people simply cannot afford to buy homes where they want to live. And that means higher density, higher quality, and affordable housing, where the state is interventionist when it needs to be, and we are under the current housing policy. But ultimately, we've got to find a way of building more homes in the right places, properly connected for sustainable urban living, and also allowing people to build homes where they come from. And, you know, Fine Gael will prioritise housing for the remainder of the lifetime of this government, because we do think that housing and healthcare really are the two big issues.
I want to bring in Matt Carty here. Matt, your party colleague Pierce Doherty jumped all over those comments in the Dáil this week, accusing the government of being out of touch. But wasn't the Taoiseach just stating a fact that house prices are now lower than they were during the Celtic Tiger era?
Well, I have to say, some of the house prices I have seen have been absolutely staggering over the past number of months, and the housing situation does have a ring to the Celtic Tiger about it. But I think it just shows that once again, and I think you've heard this in the minister's commentary just now, that the government are simply missing the point. From where we are sitting here in the Dublin Bay South constituency, there are young couples that are paying an excess of €2,000 per month in rent. Those people, for so long as Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are direct in housing policy, will never be in a situation where they can buy their own home. Unheard of. These are people who are in what would be considered in any other generation to be well-paying jobs, people who can secure their own home for their own family. And this boils down to an entire lack of comprehension in terms of where the source of the housing crisis that we now find ourselves in. And that goes back to the failure of government to invest in housing, invest in social and affordable housing, building public housing on public land and actually providing the supports. What we got instead was a policy that has been a long time in coming in terms of successive generations, but has been intensified for the period the Fine Gael have been in government, which essentially involves the privatisation and outsourcing of housing policy. So rather than building housing, we are now in the process of spending hundreds of millions of euro every year and growing every year in subsidies to private landlords rather than actually developing houses as has been done in previous generations.
Jennifer Whitmore, can I ask you, I mean, what did you make of those comments from the Taoiseach during the week when he pointed out the fact that house prices are substantially lower than the Celtic Tiger era?
I think the Taoiseach and Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil and the Greens really need to talk to people on the ground, because this isn't what people are seeing on the ground. People are facing huge pressures when it comes to renting, to buying their own homes and just being able to afford to live. Issues like childcare are causing enormous stress. And so, you know, we can have these Ardèche speeches and we can have the minister come on here and make all these promises, make all these statements. But the reality is, for the past 10 years, rents have doubled in price. Like, that's what people are seeing on the ground, and that's what they have to live with. So the promises and the statements mean nothing to them because they're not seeing action. And the as Matt said, the government's It's raison d'etre that its entire direction of policy is in relation to outsourcing government responsibility.
Do you want to see those rents? Do you want to see those rents frozen?
That's simply not true, Justin. Sorry, I mean, I
Are you saying it's not true, Minister, that rents have doubled? Because they absolutely have.
No, sorry.
The reason I intervened at 5%.
Sorry, Jennifer. The reason I intervened in terms of what you're saying is when you said that the government is simply outsourcing the housing problem to the private sector. Like, that is completely untrue.
The whole HAP system is based on
if you could just let me explain why that's not true. We are now spending over 3 billion euros a year on housing. This is public money investing in public housing,
and
affordable housing,
some of it is
on HAP, because you cannot build 30,000 houses overnight. So what we are doing is, of course, we are relying on subsidising rent for people. But that is because we have got to catch
Justin,
up in terms
say
of
this.
Supply.
I want to ask the minister.
Why, Minister, is the government so resistant to freezing rents?
Well, we haven't been resistant to it. I mean,
but it hasn't been done.
Sorry, I was the first minister in the history of the state, as a housing minister, to intervene on rental prices, to actually put a cap on what rental inflation could be. And we took a lot of legal advice on that to avoid legal challenge and so on. So it was the Fine Gael government that actually introduced a cap on rent. So just to be clear.
But that cap has turned into a target for landlords as opposed to actually reducing prices.
Yeah, and we're looking at that as well. Okay, and during the pandemic period, we have prevented evictions and we've put a cap on any rental increases. So we have been doing what people have been calling for.
Justin, the minister had 18 minutes uninterrupted at the beginning of this programme. So I don't think it's actually fair that then he interrupts every speaker.
I'm just trying to be accurate, Matt.
Well, you're not being accurate, actually, Minister. And in fact, you're being disingenuous to suggest that the government are committed to freezing rents when the evidence points to the very clear fact that you have opposed every single measure. And those limited measures that you have been forced to deliver, you've done so under intensive political pressure. And if we want to actually see, and I think this is clear to everybody, and I think this is part of the reason why we see the rhetoric from your party in recent days, because there is now a recognition that if you want to change housing policy, then you need to change the parties of government, because Fine Gael are just so out of touch that they do not have the imagination, they do not have the ambition, and they certainly don't have the vision that's required to actually deliver the type of ambitious house building programme that's required.
Do you not see a problem, though, McCarthy, with freezing rents, that perhaps what you're going to end up doing is driving landlords out of the market and you're not going to have rental properties available?
Rent freezes on their own wouldn't work, Justin, and we've always said that rent freezes need to form part of a comprehensive framework in terms of how we deal with housing. And at the core of that, it has to be house building, of course. And at the core of that has to be building public houses on public lands, building houses that people can actually afford. So we have seen an instance, and the Minister has alluded to councillors rejecting housing proposals. Those proposals that have been rejected have been houses that have been built on private lands, being given away in secret, in sweetheart deals to private developers. That's not what's required. We need private developers to build on private land, and we encourage and support that, but we need public houses.
Justin, if I could just respond to that.
Just briefly, Minister.
The big difference between Fine Gael and Sinn Féin here is that Sinn Féin, their housing policy is solely about building social housing.
It's not.
Nothing else.
It's not.
Of people in Ireland want to be able to afford to buy their own home. They want to buy private housing. Many people who can't afford to buy their own home need the state to intervene in terms of affordable housing schemes, cost rental schemes, and social housing.
Minister, people who want to buy their private homes are currently renting and paying exorbitant rents, and they're receiving
between
no support from your government.
The difference between Sinn Féin and Fine Gael is we want mixed tenure communities, where everybody can live as neighbours, side by side, regardless of whether they can afford to buy homes or whether they have to rely on the state for social homes.
Instead, what you want to do in Sinn Féin is build acres and acres of social housing, Justin, and that won't work. The reality of Fine Gael and government is that those people that the Minister is saying Fine Gael want to support are actually locked into a vicious cycle that's becoming more pronounced, whereby they're paying huge sums in terms of rental accommodation. They can't therefore save a deposit. And then when they do get to a point over the last year, many people were able to save some money because of the pandemic and the results of it. And what they've seen is house prices actually increase beyond their means yet again.
Jennifer Whitmore, can I bring you in here? I mean, does the Minister have a point where you do need that mix, that those mixed tenure communities?
You absolutely do need a mix. The housing crisis is an issue. It's a jigsaw issue, really. There's a whole lot of solutions to it. And we need to address each of them. But listening to the Minister, you wouldn't think he's been in government for 10 years. I mean, this isn't an issue that's just cropped up in the last year. This has been building for years and years. And opposition and the Social Democrats have been calling on the government to change their focus. We have a housing crisis. Everything is upside down in this country. Yeah. We have people living in hotels, and we have, you know, hotels and Airbnbs. I mean, the whole system is wrong. So the market is wrong, and bringing in a rent freeze, what we're doing is saying we don't want any further rent increases. The market is already distorted, and there needs to be intervention in it, because people cannot survive in the current system.
Matt Carthy, I just want to go back to you on the discussion around Northern Ireland, and that to get your reaction to that Loyalist Communities Council statement urging the DUP to stop concessions to Sinn Féin, and also warning Irish government ministers and officials that they're not welcome in Northern Ireland. What's your reaction to that?
Oh, I think it was a disgraceful and very unwelcome intervention by a group of people that, let's remember, have no mandate and very little support within any community in the North. Of course, government ministers, North or South, are free to go anywhere in our country. And I think the evidence would point to a very warm welcome for any elected government minister.
On that deal done with the Northern Secretary Brandon Lewis involving your own party leader and Edwin Poots, isn't it remarkable that a party that boycotts Westminster would go cap in hand to the UK government and ask it to push Irish language legislation through a parliament that you refused to sit in?
No, and we didn't go cap in hand to anybody. We simply insisted that agreements that had been signed up to were actually delivered. Remember that the Irish language legislation, and as the Minister has pointed out, encompassing the rights of Ulster Scots speakers also, was agreed 15 years ago. It was subsequently agreed on a number of occasions, including when the DUP and Sinn Féin and the other parties in the executive agreed the New Decade, New Approach agreement. So this was simply about implementing agreements. Our preference would have been that we could have brought this legislation through the Assembly and got agreement.
Doesn't it completely undermine the Assembly when you have to go to Westminster to get that legislation through?
I think it completely undermines the DUP's limited and narrowing assertions that they're up for equality and up for delivering rights for all sections of the community. This is an important issue for some. We would have hoped, and I think most people would have expected, that the Irish language legislation would have been in place many years ago and that political efforts could be concentrating on other very important social and economic issues.
Yeah, there are other social and economic issues. I mean, the New Decade, New Approach document outlines around 80 different recommendations, including, I think, more police, more healthcare staff, more teachers and so on. So why was Irish language plucked out of that ahead of all of those things?
Because Irish language was the one area where the DUP categorically said they had no intention of delivering within
it was
the
made a
framework
priority.
Of the Assembly.
It was
one part of the discussions around the implementation of the New Decade, New Approach agreement. And it was the one area where the DUP categorically said they had no intention of actually fulfilling their obligations. So therefore, there was a responsibility. The two governments are guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement and subsequent agreements, and therefore the British government, who had the facility to deliver this legislation, had an obligation to do so, and the agreement was simply an acknowledgement of that.
Okay, Minister, just, very briefly.
I think it's important for your listeners to just to sort of understand the context around why the Irish language legislation is so important to so many people in Northern Ireland, because even for people who don't speak Gaeilge, it's the symbolic nature of what the calls for an Irish language bill have become that have made this so emotive. So this is really about, for many nationalists in Northern Ireland, wanting a recognition from unionism that Irishness is part of Northern Ireland too. And the Irish language has become the totem for that. So what they want to see is unionist leadership recognising that Irish culture and Irish language is part of Northern Ireland and its history and its communities and so on. And while unionism resists that, many in nationalist communities see that as unionism not recognising who Irish people are in terms of their culture and their identity and so on.
Okay.
And so identity-based politics in Northern Ireland is always highly emotive, which is why for many unionists, the protocol is what undermines their identity as British people, which is why they're so resistant to it. So these issues, of course, you're right, you know, healthcare, teachers, and many of the bread and butter issues that are so important to the functioning of any country are important in the New Decade, New Approach Agreement. But Irish language legislation, along with Ulster Scots legislation, was in many ways the obstacle that prevented agreement for about 18 months in those negotiations. And that's why we finally got a compromise deal that everybody accepted. And that's why it's important that it gets implemented. And the British government agrees with that position.
All right.
And that's why they've said if politicians in Northern Ireland cannot follow through on their commitments here, that the British government will do that.
All right. I'm going to have to take a break. We'll talk about travel after this.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Justin McCarthy sitting in for Katie for the next couple of weeks. Now, work is ongoing to adopt the new EU digital COVID certificates on July 19th. It will allow for international travel within the EU. David Rock is CEO of RockDoc and runs a PCR testing facility at a number of airports around the country. And he's on the line. David, good afternoon. Can you tell
us,
how does your testing facility work?
Yes, so we have testing facilities in your two in Dublin, Cork, Shannon and Knock. So the facility itself is set up to do PCR, antigen, antibody and LAMP testing. So the testing services that we have is all for passengers travelling, but also for industry, for offices and pharmaceutical.
And people book ahead, do they?
Yeah, they have to book ahead on covidtech.ie. The important thing is that we've noticed a little bit of a spike now for July and August. So it's really important that people do book ahead, because what we don't want to do is what happened at Christmas time, where it was all last minute booking.
Okay.
I mean, we have capacity.
And is your service then, is it integrated in with the EU digital COVID certification process? Well, if people get a test on or after July 19th, will they then be included in that sort of digital passport?
Yeah, quite recently we've been working quite closely with the department to integrate the systems together to make sure that on July 19th we're all ready for road, as they say. We're made a very lot of headway in the last five to 6 days on this project, so we're quite happy that we'll be ready to go, as they say, on the D-Day.
Okay, and unvaccinated people, they'll have to get a PCR test, isn't that right? And how much is that going to cost?
So with ourselves, it's €95 for a PCR, and the results are back within 24 hours.
So it's not cheap, really, is it? I mean, if you had, we'll say, four children, presumably you have to get a test when you come back into the country as well, if it's outside that 72-hour period or whatever. So you could be looking at close to £400 to bring your four kids back and forth each ways.
Yeah, I think the important thing to remember, this isn't just a rapid test. This isn't something that can be done quite easily. It's done in a full laboratory with trained laboratory technicians, with a lot of infrastructure and clinical governance behind it. So although there is a cost associated with it, the cost with that does come as a result of a true result, an accurate result that goes through a lot of work.
What kind of demand is there at the moment?
At the moment, it's quite low, but we do see it already beginning to go up since the bank holiday weekend. We've noticed we've had a few spikes, and as I say, in July and August, we've had some spikes in bookings as well. So I suppose the big take-home message is, if anybody is going to go on holidays, it's really just to book well in advance. Otherwise, it'll be first come, first served, and that's not where we want it to go.
Okay. David Rock, CEO of RockDoc, thank you very much indeed for talking to us there. Minister Coveney, are there any plans for the government to subsidise people who have to take PCR tests for foreign travel?
No, that's not part of the proposal at the moment. I mean, we have an enormous job to do to get a system up and running effectively over the next 3 weeks to a month to allow people to travel safely. Because there's if you look at the categories of people who will now be able to travel without having to quarantine in other countries in Europe. It'll be people who are fully vaccinated, people who have recovered from COVID in the last 9 months, and people who get PCR tested 72 hours before they land in a destination somewhere else in the EU. So there's about 2.5 million people that are going to have to be on a database that in order to ensure that we can facilitate international travel for Irish people under this new digital COVID
certification. There's a little bit of confusion as well, isn't there, over because the CMO said during the week that the public health advice is for people who aren't vaccinated not to travel.
Yeah.
And yet the digital certification process does allow for people to travel.
Yeah, so I think there's a difference between what is the most prudent thing to do from a public health perspective. So, I and my family are choosing to holiday at home this year, just like we did last year. But we're also saying that if people want to travel, then we are putting in place a system that allows them to do that. But of course, if you're not vaccinated and you're traveling abroad, we are still living with a global pandemic, and there are dangers with that when you travel abroad into another country where you may not fully understand the regulations
so
and so
prudence.
On. So I think it is. But look, I mean, I think we have also said we've set the date of the 19th of next month for the reopening of international travel, particularly within the EU under this new COVID cert system. And so people who want to travel will be facilitated through the system, but it is a very complex piece of infrastructure to put in place.
Will it be ready?
And we only have a few weeks to do it. Yes, it will be ready.
Okay.
There are a number of government departments involved in that discussion, coordinated by the Taoiseach, my department, obviously health, also justice and transport, in terms of making sure that our systems in our airports, because this isn't just about facilitating Irish people travelling, it's also about facilitating other EU citizens travelling to Ireland as well.
Yes.
Without, hour-long queuing systems in our, or hours-long potentially,
I want to bring
our airports.
Jennifer Whitmore in. Jennifer, do you think that those PCR tests for people who are going on holidays should be subsidised?
Look, I mean, I suppose that's going to have to be examined by the government as part of the overall package.
What's your
and
own
supports
view?
For it. I wouldn't have any, I suppose, metrics on the cost of it, how many we would be talking about. And obviously the overall costs would have to play into, be a factor in the decision. But I suppose there's also the issue then of whether we need to be looking at the antigen testing and not, you know, just focusing on the PCR as a part of the package. And I know that the Oireachtas Transport Committee have called for a pilot programme in antigen testing, and that could be a more feasible way of actually facilitating people to travel. And I suppose what I don't quite understand is why it's not been looked at as part of aviation, and yet Minister Simon Harris is incorporating it as part of opening the colleges. So, yeah. You know, we have different departments within government are saying different things about the antigen testing. So
I'll come to you, Minister, in a moment on that. Yes. But Matt Carty, do you have a sympathy for young people here? I mean, I know vaccination is going to be opened up shortly for the under 40s and so on, but it'll be a long time before people in their 20s get vaccinated, a couple of months anyway. And, you know, it'll probably be after the summer. And it's very expensive, isn't it, to be getting PCR tests if you're going to be travelling?
It is, and we can only hope and expect that the vaccine rollout will continue apace, and that, you know, we will all get to a point where the vaccination process has reached that cohort as quickly as possible. But yes, it is. It is expensive. I think it is important that we have robust rules that allow aviation and the tourism sectors to reopen, while at the same time ensuring that we're very solid in terms of the public health advice. We don't want to repeat any mistakes that actually result in new waves and new variants coming into place. The Transport Committee, as Jennifer has said, have asked for a pilot scheme to be incorporated. We've been calling for that as a party since the beginning of May. I think we need to have very clear rationale as to whether that's going to happen, and if not, why not?
Will that happen, Minister? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I mean, just first of all, on the, you know, whether the state should subsidise PCR tests for people looking to travel. I mean, I think you do have to ask yourself the question: should we be using public money subsidising international travel for people who aren't vaccinated in the middle of a global pandemic?
You know, well, I suppose some people do have essential reasons for travelling.
I totally accept that, right? I totally accept that, but you know, this isn't just about being popular. It's also about trying to do the right public health thing and also prioritising our spend on protecting people by and large.
Sure. So antigen testing, though, would be a lot cheaper. So why haven't we got a pilot project on that?
Yeah, and that's a fair question. And I mean, the answer to the question is we know PCR testing is far more accurate. Mm. And that's why the public health advice to government is, for something as important as international travel, to ensure that we're not re-importing the problem, reseeding the problem and potentially including new variants coming into the country, we've got to be as accurate as we possibly can be when facilitating international travel to know whether whether people are carrying this virus or not. And that is why, you know, PCR tests we know are more accurate. There is a role for antigen testing. I think antigen testing is going to be used extensively in the autumn, particularly on university campuses. It's already being used in many businesses that are trying to facilitate people coming back, you know, back onto the work floor,
but
and
Minister,
so on.
Are you not saying two different things there? You're saying that it's not okay for travel, but it is okay for large congregated settings such as universities and colleges.
No, what I'm saying is that it's not as accurate as PCR tests, but it still gives you around a 70% accuracy, which is a very useful tool because it's far cheaper. But if you're choosing in the context of government policy on international travel, then our preference is to use the more accurate test. Yes, it's more expensive, but I think the importance of international travel in terms of trying to manage this pandemic justifies that. When you're talking about getting students back onto campuses and so on, antigen testing is far from perfect, but it's certainly a useful tool that can manage and reduce risk. And like what we're talking about throughout this pandemic is about managing risk. There's no perfect answer when it comes to international travel or other public health management, but
the digital COVID certificate covers the EU. I want to talk about travel to the UK now, and I want to go to Ian Davies, who is Stena Line's head of UK ports. Good afternoon, Ian.
Good afternoon. Yeah, good afternoon, everyone.
There are new rules announced this week. Fully vaccinated travellers coming to Ireland from Britain will have to self-quarantine for 14 days, which can be ended if you get a negative PCR test after 5 days. Do you expect that that will change once the EU digital COVID certificate comes into effect on the 19th of July?
Yeah, well, indications are that we've been told is from the 19th, fully vaccinated passengers will not have to self-isolate coming into Ireland from the 19th. And we welcome that. Obviously, we follow government guidelines on these things. The government health officials give us guidance on this, and we fully welcome that. And so it's a start. I think it's a start about reconnecting. You know, everyone talks about aviation, but the maritime sector has been operating throughout the pandemic, not only supporting the Irish economy through bringing of goods, but obviously we are open for essential travel as well. And we've maintained those links. So I think whereas we welcome the 19th, what we are also looking for really is clarity on a roadmap forward, really, and some kind of recognition on the common travel area. Yes. The common travel area has existed since the 1920s. It's pre-EU. And yet, when you look at the proposals for non-vaccinated persons, the common travel area is treated differently from the EU.
Okay, we'll ask the Minister about that in a moment. But I just want to ask you, you have launched a new temporary passenger service between Belfast and Holyhead. When does that start, and what's the demand like there at the moment?
So that starts next weekend. We're taking one of our ships off the Holyhead Dublin route, and it's really just to meet demand. So demand on our Liverpool Belfast route is now double what it was in 2019, double pre-pandemic. We're also seeing a big increase in our other routes into Belfast, and unfortunately, we are seeing a 55% reduction into Dublin.
Okay, can I ask you about passengers then who use that Holyhead to Belfast route? Do they have to fill out passenger locator forms when they arrive into Belfast?
No.
Okay, so then potentially it could be used as a backdoor into the Republic of Ireland, couldn't it?
I suppose potentially it could be. We're not aware of that, but I suppose, yes, potentially it could be.
All right. OK, well, Ian, thank you very much for talking to us there, Minister. Would you be concerned at all about that a service like that might be used, you know, if there isn't going to be checks on the passengers arriving into Belfast from Holyhead? There's nothing stopping them crossing the border, is there?
Yeah, look, I mean, this has been an issue for many months now. It's not just ferry traffic. It's also people flying into Belfast from GB and then getting in a car and driving south to Dublin or some other location south of the border. And that has been an issue. We've been very clear that people who travel into the Republic of Ireland through Northern Ireland from an overseas location, whether that's GB or whether it's somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in Europe,
okay,
have a legal obligation.
Yeah, they're the rules.
And there are spot checks, okay, that the guards undertake in relation to that. What we would like, of course, is a full sharing of information from Northern Ireland to ourselves and vice versa in terms of people who are travelling into Dublin and travelling on then to Northern Ireland, whereby, by the way, if people fly into Dublin Airport, they are required to fill out a passenger locator form, even if their final destination is Northern Ireland, and we give them a very clear instruction on what's expected of them in Northern Ireland. That isn't reciprocated the other way around. But look, we're always trying to manage a common travel area between Britain and Ireland, obviously keeping an open border between North and South. And that has been a real challenge through this pandemic. But just to reassure people, you know, the authorities in Northern Ireland and ourselves talk all the time. Stephen Donnelly yesterday spoke to Robin Swan. The CMOs speak virtually every week.
All right.
We are trying to manage these things as best we can.
All right. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the controversy over the National Maternity Hospital.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
Welcome back to the programme. Justin McCarthy standing in for Katie. Now, next Wednesday, the Dáil will debate a Social Democrats motion seeking to ensure that the site of the new National Maternity Hospital is bought by the state. During the week, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said safeguards around the leasing agreement for the new hospital were not strong enough, and he also said there was a difficulty that the hospital's board would not be appointed by the government. During the week, Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly also told government TDs and opposition TDs that the state has tried to do everything possible to buy the land that the new maternity hospital will be built on. Jennifer Whitmore, this is your party's motion. What's the concern here? I mean, the Sisters of Charity have said the new hospital will have clinical and operational independence. So what's the problem?
So the Sisters of Charity will be setting up there'll be an organisation set up to run the new maternity hospital, and it will be run in accordance with the Catholic ethos. So we have two issues with it. One is that the state will be putting in €800 million into investing in a hospital that will essentially be given over to a private entity. And the second issue then, of course, relates to the provision of healthcare for women and the potential for that healthcare to be given in accordance with religious ethos, which we absolutely cannot countenance in this country
anymore.
But
the Sisters of Charity said that there is no suggestion of that, that there will be no, I mean, the hospital will have clinical and operational independence.
That is absolutely not. I do not believe that. Not many people actually do believe it. And we do welcome the Taoiseach's response during the week to say that he does have concerns about the governance of this as well.
So how do you move forward then?
The state needs to buy this land, either buy it or CPO it. But a decision needs to be made quickly, because we've been waiting years and we've had promises and promises about how this hospital will be independent. But, you know, we need to make a decision on it, and they need to move on it quickly.
A CPO, though, a compulsory purchase order, could result in years of delays with legal challenges ending up in the courts and being tied up for a long time.
Well, we've had years of delays already. You know, I think the issue with this is that the government is trying to square a circle that just isn't going to happen. The church will not allow its land to be used to provide services that go against the religious ethos of that organisation. And so, you know, we're essentially asking the impossible. So I think we do need to cut the cord with this at some stage, and for the government to just make a decision and build it somewhere else.
And build it somewhere else, you think?
Well, if that's what needs to be done, that's what needs to be done. I know that the ideal is that it's co-located, but what we absolutely need is healthcare that's based on science and medicine and not religious ethos. And women, we cannot make another mistake like this again. Can I just also say that the Minister was talking earlier on about how the Fine Gael policy, or, you know, they're driving towards a good governance and fiscal prudence and investment in healthcare. This government is about to hand over $800 million to a private entity that will give healthcare that is substandard to women in this country. And
we don't know that, in fairness. We don't know that. And well, I want to ask Matt Carty. Matt, do you think that hospital should be built somewhere else if the land can't be purchased?
I think I welcome as well the belated acknowledgement by Leo Varadkar that there are serious questions that need to be resolved in this. To me, it is bizarre that we would consider investing that money. And we know from the National Children's Hospital that these things can become much more expensive than the estimates might first indicate. So this needs to be in public ownership. My preference is that the National Maternity Hospital is built quickly. And therefore, I think the easiest solution would be for the Sisters of Charity to gift the land to the state.
Okay.
I think that would be an appropriate way to resolve this matter.
Minister, why hasn't the government or the state contacted the Religious Sisters of Charity and asked them about purchasing the land? They say that they have not been contacted by the government about this.
Well, because this is a decision for the St Vincent's Hospital Group. The Sisters of Charity, of course, have representation on that group, but it's far broader than the nuns themselves. The key issues here are around three issues: governance, ownership, and ensuring that all services are available to women. And I don't think there is any suggestion that healthcare is going to be provided in a national maternity hospital in a way that's consistent with religious ethos. Nobody is suggesting that.
Minister,
not even the nuns.
St Vincent's Hospital will not provide the service of IVF, sterilisation. They won't even provide the coil if it's for birth control purposes. How can you say that you're going to prevent this happening? You absolutely can't. And there's no hospital or no grounds or lands in the world where the church allows terminations to happen on its land. So I don't understand how you're so certain about this.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm not going to get into examples around the world. What I'm saying is the government has to make a final decision on this issue. I, as a government minister that's been around for a while,
have seen
two memos on this, but not for decision yet. The government is not going to spend 800 million euros of taxpayers' money unless we have absolute guarantees around governance and independence, ownership, and ensuring that all services are available on the basis of modern healthcare for women.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That's our lot for this week. Thanks to my panel for being here. The programme was produced by Mary O'Hagan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. And on sound today was Cara O'Hare. I'll be back again next Saturday. But for now, thanks for listening. Take care and have a great weekend.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.